go back and, you know, devote more time to reading about it. One of the things I realized is that this part of the course where we're doing more on gastronomy or food satisfaction, really, it's about collecting stories. And so I think these are some neat stories. So let's see if we can get these out together. So this is Dan Barber writing. I'm going to maybe chill you out a little bit here. Close it. I know, because you're not warm.
No, I'm
good. That's fine. Push it closed when you get cold. So this is Dan Barber starting this story with a story about the tomato fungus that affected this cool restaurant, Stone Barn, which you know about now. And so it's an interesting story because the tomato funguses occur in plants naturally as varieties. And in this case, these were plants that were coming out of an industrial center and being shipped by tractor trailer all over the Northeast. And the detail for your notes is that this industrial production of plants does have a liability, which is that as these trailers were going around the countryside, they were literally spewing fungus spores that could travel 40 miles. And so the tomato fungus was terrible. It was a big problem, exacerbated by the industrial distribution of plants. That's relevant because the chapter's going to go into a lot of detail about where our seeds come from. And this is a part of the course that we really haven't, this is a part of the food story that we really haven't gotten anything on. The point for your notes is that behind food production, there have been for 10,000 years people who have continually created varietals of foods to adapt, to avoid things like funguses, and to adapt to get higher yields in particular ecological niches. So plant breeding, the point for your notes is that plant breeding is part of our food system, and the historical example is that I've given you is 5000 BC, Mesoamerica, in about a 10 to 20 year period, somehow people figured out how to breed wild corn into the corn we know today. And so you know this, I've told you this already, but wild corn is these teeny little ears and you couldn't live off of it. You know, the corn that we have today is a monster by comparison. It's a freak, right? When we breed an animal like that, we all get freaked out because it's like, oh my gosh, you've got chickens that are falling over and they can't, their bones don't form right, okay? But in the case of plants, you know, plant breeding it's part of agriculture and it's been done naturally, for 10,000 years. So we're going to kind of see that side of it. So in the tomato fungus story, the only other detail I'd mention is that these, in the corner, so the tomatoes at Stone Barns all capitulated to the fungus, but this one group of mountain magic tomatoes survived the fungus. So Barber's asking his farmer guy, Jack, you know, so what's up with the mountain magics? And it turns out they're the product of Cornell University breeders who created this variety that was resistant to the fungus, right? So this is a way of introducing the larger question of how do we do this? So you get a little background, take a couple of notes if you would on the land grant system. So back in 1862 when we created the Department of Agriculture, we set up in every state land grant universities. So in this state it would be Washington State University in Pullman. And each university was charged to keep seed banks and plant experts who could continue to create varietals that were adapted to the farmers of that state. Very cool. One of the smartest, I mean, there's a lot in this course that where we criticize the U.S. food system. This is one of the best things that our country ever did because that system allowed farmers, eventually they added the experimental station and the extension service. Does anybody know what ag extension agents are? Do any of you come from backgrounds where you know? Ag extension agents exist in every county in the U.S. as far as I'm aware, and they're experts who you could call as a farmer to come out and help you with problems or give you, and they send updates to farmers about things, and they're connected to the researchers at the land grant institution. So that's our system for creating varietals, mostly to avoid diseases and increase yields, right? It's a kind of security system by the federal government for helping farmers. So then he shifts gears a little bit, and he tells you about this wheat called Aragon 3. So Aragon 3 is a wheat that's grown, still grown in a part of Spain, even though most Spanish wheat growers have adopted commercial varieties. And the cool thing about Aragon 3 wheat is that it's in high demand in a couple of Southeast Asian countries because it's prized for the kinds of noodles that are used there. It's a high quality wheat. So it almost disappeared, but so this is the point for your notes is that this is an example of terroir for wheat, right? Because here's a wheat that was saved, it's a varietal that has special characteristics. It can be grown other places besides this part of Spain. So it's not like other terroir where it's unique to that place, like we were looking at the geese and the pigs eating the acorns in Spain. But it's an example of a specialty wheat that that might change. That Barber wants to make this point. It could be that we've been looking at wheat the wrong way. We've been looking at it as a product that where the place that it's grown doesn't matter, and the freshness of it doesn't matter. And so the direction we're going to go here is the idea that maybe we should be thinking about wheat as a local fresh product. And that's pretty challenging. I mean, I, like most of you, I grew up with the roller mill wheat in the big paper bags that came in 5-pound bags that you bought and stuck in the cupboard for months, right? And so what this line of thinking is suggesting is that maybe that was a mistake. Okay, so let's get Steve Jones' story out. Originally, he was at WSU. Now he's at this place called that we refer to as the Bread Lab. It's actually technically an extension center of the Washington State Land Grant System at Mount Vernon on the west side. And the cool story, which I really wish you'd gotten to read because Barbara told it pretty well, but let's see if we can get it in your notes, is that one day Steve Jones is working as a faculty member at WSU. He's a plant geneticist. He's a big deal. And some people from Monsanto come and visit. And they're doing this all over the country. And what they do is they say, hey, you guys have what we need. Every land-grant institution has seed banks. And so industrial suppliers like Monsanto started to approach land-grant programs and get them to agree to do research for Monsanto, which would allow joint licensing of new seed products. So these programs are being now majority funded by these kinds of agreements. And they do fulfill the original purpose of land grant institutions because they're trying to create new varieties that have high yields and are resistant. But what Monsanto wanted him to do is help develop a variety of wheat that would be resistant to Roundup. So Monsanto already had soybeans that were resistant to Roundup. And you know about the Roundup cancer lawsuit that's going forward, so there are some issues here. And in that meeting, he didn't get excited and about this. Although he was, you know, the faculty members make money too. It's a pretty interesting system. So the idea is, you help me make a Roundup resistant wheat seed, and we license it, and your department gets money, you get a lot of money, we get a lot of money, and the farmers can't keep their own seeds. You know that story, right? Okay, so what does Steve Jones do? This is why he's my hero. He just walks out of the meeting and says, I'm not going to do that. I work for the public. I mean, for 10,000 years. I work in a tradition of, he literally says it, I work in a tradition of 10,000 years of plant breeders. And our job is to serve the public. And you want me to basically help you license a private product that would no longer be in the public interest. So you know the story, right? I mean, you know the background story to that. So he walks out, and he lasts a few more years. He's a tenured faculty member, so he could stay there. But what they wind up doing is moving him to the west side to this extension center, which is technically a demotion. But he's a rock star. So what he does is he creates this incredibly innovative wheat research space and an associated bread lab, which has outreach to people who are, you know, who want to improve their So as he's moving west, he tells this story about coming across, any of you live near the Skagit Valley? I said it the wrong way, Skagit Valley. And he's like, why are people growing wheat in the Skagit Valley? Well, it turns out they're growing, like the Spanish farmers, they're growing a niche wheat that's highly popular in Asian countries that have specialty noodles that benefit from this wheat. And what's cool about that, in addition to that, is that because they can get the price for that wheat crop, it's a specialty crop, they can use wheat as a rotation crop. So put it in your notes this way. If we could treat wheat as a specialty crop, which would mean it make it more expensive, then farmers could use it as a rotation crop. So our choice to eat better wheat could be could open up a possibility for less dependence on fertilizer, because if you can use wheat as a rotation crop, you're not using as much fertilizer to supply the soil, right? So it's a cool connection between, there's a nutrition side to this. It's a cool connection between soil health and nutrition and satisfaction, because in making that trade-off, are you with me? In making that trade-off, we're going to get better tasting wheat. We're going to treat it differently, say, treat it as a fresh product, and it's going to affect our farming practices in a positive way. So that's good. So he meets with these farmers in the Skagit Valley, and he says, "Wow, I didn't realize you guys were growing wheat. I happen to be relocating here, you know, blah blah blah." They have this big long story. He said, "I'd like to help you. I'd like to look at some of the wheat varieties you're doing. This is really cool that you're planting wheat here in the Skagit Valley." And then they have this meeting, and they say to him at the end of the meeting, "Okay, one thing though, if we come up with new wheat varieties, you can't license them," which is exactly what he wants to hear. They're basically saying, you know, if you want to work with us, you need to put everything we come up with back in the public domain. And so the farmers just had the message that he was, you know, wanting to hear. So it's a neat story because it starts with a really tense standoff with one kind of agriculture, and then he finds his happiness. And as you can tell from the picture, he looked like a pretty happy guy, right? And so I'd love to go and meet somebody like that. But so that's kind of his story. Let's see. Questions about that? So there's this, that's the nice narrative moment, is when he's with the farmers and they tell him, okay, you know, we'll work with you, but you can't license what we're doing. Okay, here's a couple of small details that I learned from this chapter and didn't know before. One is Barber's asking him, you know, can you develop better wheat? I left out an important part. Barber writes to Steve Jones. He's heard about him, and he says, "Hey, I've heard about this Aragon 3 wheat that they grow in Spain. Do you know anything about it?" And Jones, by the time Jones writes back, he's already gotten seeds from his seed bank, and he's already kind of planting a little bit of it to see what it's like. And so they're going to work together to make to kind of make a wheat variety that Stone Barns Restaurant will actually grow and serve. And at the end, they call it Barber Wheat. He actually develops a wheat variety. By the end of the chapter, you hear about it. So here's the two details. One is, Barber asks him, "Can you get high flavor and high yield?" And here's his answer. It's interesting. He says, In plants that have been selected for larger fruits and more water, that's hard to do, because to get flavor, to enhance flavor when there's that much water in the food is very difficult. But with plants that don't have a lot of water in them, like wheat, you can actually get high flavor and high yield. So this is kind of an interesting point. And the second point was that older wheat, and I've heard this in other cases besides wheat, older wheat varieties had higher nutrition. So again, the point for your notes is that we might be able to cultivate specialty kinds of wheat based on these older varieties that have high yield, high flavor. Okay. Now a lot of that is what we're taking out with roller mills. So that's the one story. So on the one hand, what we're really juxtaposing today is Steve Jones versus Howard Moskowitz. Because in the moving then to the second chapter, I think that's most of what we needed from this. Moving then to the second chapter, it was the Skagit Valley wheat was going to Korea and Singapore to be made into noodles and soft breads. Isn't that cool? Okay. So then going to the second chapter, you meet this guy, Howard Moskowitz, and Maybe you guys can help with this since you actually had this reading. And this guy is also a rock star. This is a guy who figured out cherry vanilla Dr. Pepper. Do any of you drink? Have any of you tasted cherry vanilla Dr. Pepper? Dr. Pepper was in trouble. So foods get into trouble, and they call people like Howard Moskowitz to figure it out. And the reason he's a genius rock star in food science is because he figured out a few things, and some of you in business and marketing really might like this. He figured out a few things that no one had figured out before. For example, in the Maxwell, now you guys have read this, so maybe you know this, but in the Maxwell, what was the Maxwell House innovation? What did he figure out with Maxwell House, the coffee? Coffee was in trouble, and yeah.
There's like three specific types of people, and they like weak, medium, and strong.
Yeah, he was the first person to figure out that there are taste demographics, that in a population of people, you're not necessarily searching for the right roast of coffee. You might be searching for three roasts, right? And that's totally natural to us. You know, you can't go to a store and buy coffee without having a choice of roasts. So the point for your notes is that when he gets his PhD in psychology from Harvard, he's already been doing research that allows him to come up with the innovation known as product line extension. This is kind of a neat concept, right? Product line extension, anybody remember that from the reading? What do we all encounter it when we go into the supermarket. Where do you see product line extension?
Just from like, for example, Pepsi makes different types of sodas.
Yeah.
It's just, I guess, I remember reading it and it was backwards to me, but they do it so that there's more emphasis on the main product.
Sometimes they do it to heighten emphasis on the main product. There's several reasons. That's one. One is to get to compete for shelf space in supermarkets, right? But another is to break down the demographics of taste and say, well, wow, people like this product. Maybe more people would like three versions of it. So we'll keep the original. I mean, this is second nature to American food shoppers. Europeans come to the U.S. not familiar with it. They walk into Costco or a supermarket, and they're like, wow, we still don't do this, even though they're moving in that direction. So product line extension is a marketing idea, but it's also related to taste demographics because it's based on the premise that that you might have a larger market if you can differentiate your product in various ways. So he's a really he brings high-tech statistical analysis to food tasting. And it allows him to really do some great things. Earlier in his career, you remember this detail? Earlier in his career, he worked for the military. And what's the problem in food in the military? Historically, it was to avoid nutrition-based diseases, right? We read about that earlier. Now it's to get people to eat the food because it tastes horrible, apparently. I've never eaten. And have any of you eaten rations? Some of you might be in ROTC. No. Apparently it's horrible, and soldiers regularly throw out half of their meal. But if you're fighting a war and you're not getting your nutrition, that's not good, right? So what does he figure out? Anybody remember the detail from that? Just jack up the sugar content. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Let's get both of those concepts in here. So sensory-specific satiety is the problem of a single flavor overwhelming your appetite. So what he figured out is that you need to get to the bliss point with flavors. If you go too far, you're going to kill someone's appetite. And so some of these rations had very strong flavoring in them, on the premise that that would help the soldier eat them. But what he learned was that the satiety point was very high for sugar. So you could jack a lot of sugar into a food product and not kill someone's appetite. So the concept associated with his work is the bliss point, which is a really cool concept. That the way you maximize sales of a product is to engineer a bliss point for flavors, salt, sugar, fat, but also flavors like spicy, and other things that we can taste. And I'm pretty sure he's a multimillionaire. I mean, this is the guy who put sugar in Prego tomato sauce. If you've ever tasted something in the earlier class said, oh, that's my favorite one. That's fine. You know, you should eat whatever you want. I'm not judgmental. But Prego tomato sauce is like candy. It's like putting candy on top of your... If you look at somebody looked up the sugar content in it for serving. It was crazy. It was like 20 grams. Somebody look it up. It would be interesting to see. So this is what his claim to fame is. So, yeah, let's pause there and kind of figure out what we want to say. Questions? Comments? Yeah. Did you have something? No? When you get a little scene at the end of the chapter, you remember this, and they're at the restaurant, and Moss figures, well, this is the guy who made Cherry Vanilla Coke, Dr. Pepper. He'll want some Dr. Pepper. It turns out he hates the stuff. He doesn't eat any of the food he's helped engineer. And he can actually taste the chemical in the flavor. So
it's 13 grams of carbs, but 10 of it is sugar.
Right, that's interesting.
Half cup.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right, in a half cup, so that's like a serving size.
Like
yeah. That's a lot of calories from sugar for tomatoes. You know, I mean, we were talking about a good carrot having sweetness in it, but that's huge. All right, so what I wanted to get today, and maybe we can draw some conclusions together from this. I wanted to juxtapose two models for food design, really. And both of them have claims about taste and gastronomy, right? You know, Howard Moskowitz's work is measured in billions of cases of soft drinks sold, right? So, you know, I mean, these are staggering numbers. Coke, in 2002, Coke sold 4.5 billion cases of soda. Jones is measured in a little different gastronomy. So the point for your notes would be, let's compare these two characters in terms of their models for promoting satisfaction from food, right? One has kind of a chemical food science sales model, and the other one has more of a, you know, let's use what we know about plant breeding to create really flavorful wheat, and then let's treat that product like a local fresh product. Any thoughts about this difference? It's pretty stark. What do you think? Here's our look at this point thing. Yeah, sure. So we've got these are like two models for pursuing satisfaction from food. One model is to engineer specific bliss points for food based on what we know drives people's satisfaction. The other model. And so that's an optimization. They're both optimization models, but this one's oriented toward sales, and it's a food science model. But here, what we're optimizing is natural food flavor, right? And so they're different ways of getting a similar result. What do you think about it? I mean, what do you think's at stake in the difference? Let's just try to make that clear. How does each model affect, say, the food system?
I feel like Steve is more of like micro kind of guy, mm-hmm. and Howard's more like macro. But I think that there's also like some morals and ethics involved, mm-hmm. as to just like, because I think like from what I read,
yeah.
it sounds like Howard is just trying to. Again, boost sales, and doesn't really care about like underlying things that could come of it, like from putting lots of sugar in food.
Yeah, so this is an industrial chemical model. Both of them are, you know, both of them are sophisticated in what they're doing. I like the way you said this one's a macro. Because he's doing things that can be plugged into an industrial system. Is that sort of how you're thinking?
Yeah.
And this is micro in the sense that the mission of plant breeders is traditionally to come up with varieties that work in specific environments, specific states, even parts of states. So, you know, a wheat farmer in Skagit Valley might not plant the same variety of wheat as a loose wheat farmer. This also has returns to the soil, right? So this model has a feature that the other model doesn't. This model is neutral with respect to effects on the soil, right? Or at least it doesn't have any obvious implications. Any other differences, similarities? I mean, they're both pursuing gastronomy. They're both pursuing ways of increasing our satisfaction from food.
cards working for the private like consulting world and Steve's public domain guy?
Yeah, that's good. That's a difference. This is a private profit model, and it fits into the kind of ways. And this is there's a kind of public interest here. And one of the things that's a challenge for our culture is to figure out to what extent, and we've run across this a lot in our course, to what extent is food something that has to be pursued in the public interest as opposed... Well, there's two ways of serving the public interest here. I don't want to polarize this. One way of serving the public interest is the way Steve Jones is doing it, right? Which is to create resources that are publicly owned and promote agriculture at this micro level. But you could say, Howard could say he's pursuing the public interest because he's helping corporations make more money. And I don't want to stigmatize that. I mean, that's generally something that we culturally, you know, we approve of in this culture. So he would, I mean, he'd object if you said that he wasn't pursuing the public interest. But I like your point. There are two different models for pursuing the public interest. And they're radically different in terms of who they're responsive to. So, you know, as we learned last time, last week when we were talking about the Kellogg story, where they took billions of calories out of their food and then the stock analyst came down on them, right? This model is responsive to a you know, publicly traded companies on the stock market. And they, the pressures there are very different. This model is related to actual farmers, and they experience a lot of pressures as well. But they're very different systems. Okay, what do you think? Yeah, other thoughts on this? Yeah, please.
Jones is, you know, very focused on like the very beginning of a product, I think, and Moskowitz is you know, later on down the line.
That's neat.
Still can't enter an industrial system.
That's
but
neat.
He's focusing kind of on that.
Good.
The root of it, and Moskowitz is.
Good. You're reminding me of a nice detail Barber puts into his account of Jones. He says, Barber's a chef, right? He says Jones writes the first recipe. The plant geneticist writes the first recipe for the dish because the chef has to buy the wheat, right? It's a pretty neat point when you think about it. So Barber sees him as, and it's also a nice point you're making about it coming at the beginning of the process. Barber sees him as a partner in creating really satisfying foods, analogously to the way Maxwell House, you know, food companies would see Moskowitz as a partner, but they're coming in at very different parts of the process. That's neat. Another difference is that this is a holistic method of creating a plant that serves a number of functions, including taste. This is really a way of engineering taste in relation to specific biochemical and neural responses we have to single ingredients, sugar, salt, and fat, especially, right? Single types of ingredients. Yeah, good. Other thoughts? That was a good one. Thanks. Yeah.
I kind of thought it was an interesting point. I know we already kind of
touched
on it, but how he, I guess not explicitly, but seemingly felt guilty about the stuff that he made. It's like, if you were in my situation, what would you have
done? I like that. Yeah, I liked his...
To me, it seemed like he wasn't upset on that really did the right thing for the public. It was more...
He was betraying some anxiety there, I thought. Yeah, if you want to go back and look at it, it's on page 31, too. He makes a very defensive reaction. Well, I had to survive. He didn't, because, you know, he knows, I mean, how do each of these people wind up feeling about the effect they've had on the society? I mean, this guy's, he doesn't eat the food he's helped to design.
Well, kind of going off that, it seems like Jones had the same ethical decision to make.
Yeah,
he decided
exactly.
To go
right.
To the public
right.
And not care about the money.
Absolutely.
As much, so.
Right. Right.
Kind of pro-Jones on that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they represent different food systems. That's a nice way to put it. Thanks. They represent different food systems and different value systems at the same time. So we're moving more in the course toward some value questions, and so it's kind of a good thing to bring up. Yeah, good. Well, that's kind of the contrast I wanted to make. Two more points for me, and then anything else you guys are thinking about. So this has given rise to a pet theory, which I won't pretend has any authority to. I just want to float it with you guys. And that is that... So there's something like palate shift that can occur. So the idea here is that what happens, What does it mean to move your satisfaction or gastronomy from this model to this model? And I want to suggest that that if you and maybe you guys have, probably many of you have experience with this already. Tell me what you think. It's an interesting thing about food satisfaction that when you change your diet, the old things you ate don't necessarily taste as good anymore. So you get a palate. My point was, my theory is that you have a palate based on what you're brought up with and how you've been acculturated to certain tastes and foods. So, and then that palate helps you think about, help structure your thoughts about what would be nice to eat that you aren't used to eating. But when you make a shift in your diet, you might be able to shift your palate so that if you can't imagine living without, you know, fast food, you know, I think I had a palate when I used to eat fast food. I had a palate that made me like fast food. And I don't, in retrospect, I don't say I didn't enjoy it. Of course I did. But if I were to go back and eat it now, I don't think it would taste as good. And I have done that with some foods that I stopped eating. And I went back in and I'm like, wow, I used to love this. Now, I think bacon is the exception, frankly. I think bacon would still taste yummy.
I've heard people that used to be like heavy soda drinkers say that before.
Right.
They used to drink soda every day and then they quit and going
right.
back and just...
That's a palate shift. To me, that's an example of palate shift. Does that make sense? Are there other examples out there? Yeah. People say, for instance, you can also notice this cross-culturally. For instance, in the other class, some people said that when they traveled in Europe, they'd meet Europeans who were just really surprised at how that Americans could drink sodas because they just, to a European palate, they just taste really sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and if you and like if you get off soda, then you go back to it, it tastes really sweet. Yeah. Other examples?
Well, I went to the Coca-Cola factory in Atlanta one time, and they have like the different sodas that they have it on like each continent. And they're like really, really different.
Oh, that's interesting. I had no idea.
Yeah,
that's
they're really different, and there were, I think, like Australia, I liked them, but
how
I
interesting.
I thought they were all gross.
Yeah.
I was, like,
yeah.
13.
So again, it's a it's a point about demographics of taste too. So Coke in Australia doesn't taste the same as Coke in the U.S.
Yeah, and they had some from like different African countries
right.
that they sold there in
right.
South America, and it was like all over the world. And they were all really, really different.
Did any of you go for the? Remember, Costco started selling Mexican Coke that had cane sugar in it. Did any of you go? I mean, that has a really better flavor. I mean, it's a different flavor, but you could, you know,
you can buy like anywhere.
You can get it.
Yeah.
It is everywhere.
Safeway.
Oh, okay. Good. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a practical concept in my diet because, in people's diets, I think, because when you, if you can't imagine eating a different kind of diet, say you were attracted, you would like to improve your diet in a certain way, but you're like, wow, will I get satisfaction from plant-based protein, for example? That's one that came up in a number of your diet reviews. That's a real concern. I mean, plant-based protein typically requires more flavoring to make it palatable and attractive. That's why, you know, you know that. So meat tends to be flavorful on its own because of its intrinsic ingredients.
I was just thinking about beer, actually. And as much as I would like to drink, like, nice craft beers,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of the time that I just drink crappy watered-down beers because I'm poor, right?
They're less expensive.
And they're less expensive, absolutely.
Right.
But I was just thinking, like, my year in Argentina, like, the classic, like, crappy beer is called Quilmes.
Okay.
And I drank a ton of it.
Is it a hot weather beer?
It's definitely, like, refreshing, for sure. It's cheap. Over the course of the year, and then I came back and I had, like, a Bud Light, and it was, like, really sweet.
Interesting. Right.
And just something as simple as that, it was kind of, like, unappetizing. I'm like, this is way too sweet.
Yeah, so you experienced, and in my theory, my pet theory,
yeah.
you experienced palate shift.
For sure.
So the hopeful thing about
that
is
like
that...
Like, Quilmes taste.
Say that again?
The beer in Argentina.
Yeah.
With it. I don't know if they put a lot of sugar in beer in the U.S. or
it
not.
It might be the rice. I've heard that the commercial beers, like Bud and stuff, perhaps
yeah.
would have used more rice for
mm-hmm.
grains and less hops. Is that right? Maybe some
that
there's some beer
sense.
Experts, yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, there are different sugar flavor profiles. And yeah, American commercial beer tends to be sweet and watery, fizzy, really fizzy. So there's a taste demographics to that, and you know some of it could just be the subjectivity of taste. But one of the things we're interested in is this kind of holistic connection with nutrition, satisfaction. But, okay, I have one more thing to, and then we can break. And that is to just recommend that you consider doing this. Just whether you do it for your grading scheme or not, just for yourself even, consider taking a simple product. Like this contrast got me thinking about promoting this idea to you again. Take a simple product in your diet that you may or may not want to, that you want to compare to some different version. And my example today will be, you know, Sunkist tuna. How many of you grew up eating like Sunkist or some of the major brands of tuna? And then compare it to this one. So this is one that, this is something I did, so I'm not necessarily recommending it, you know, this was my, so you'll find this at like Main Market or Huckleberry's. Maybe you'll find it at Safeway, I don't know. And it's got like 7 or 8 different stickers on it, you know, certifying different things about it. So there's a variety of reasons you might want this. I think the nutrition of a Sunkist tuna can and this is probably about the same, although this one claims to have more omega-3 oils, which might be true. I don't know. I don't know why that would be true. The point would be that maybe take the more industrial food, which I think the industrial tuna product, which looks and feels differently, just opening up the can, and then compare it to this, which looks a lot more like tuna meat, and then go ahead and investigate what it's claiming about sustainability. I'm very skeptical about fish sustainability claims. There are some people who say there's no such thing as fish sustainable catches. I think that's too strong. But the truth is, we don't know. We don't know how many fish there are in the sea. That's kind of the quest in the fish sustainability world. But we do know we're overfishing. So you might already say, well, tuna's not on my list. On the other hand, if it is, you know, make this comparison. Make the comparison based on nutrition, values reflected in these different certifications, and taste. And I've had a friend do this, and she said, yeah, I did it, and I went back to Starkist. That's where my palate is. But I would invite you to do that kind of comparison around a particular food item in your diet that you may even like, that you grew up liking. It might be a kind of tuna, a kind of bread, a kind of anything. What would you guys suggest? And then compare it to something that is maybe less bad for you, or maybe realizes a different set of values, like the tuna, and then it may not be a nutrition difference, or it may be, but I'm focused a little more on the satisfaction side of this now. And then write it up. You know, like do the experience, make the comparison, even invite some friends, taste it with you, and do the side-by-side taste comparison. And so that could be like a simple practical project if you want to do that in April. It'd be kind of instructive, especially if it's around gastronomy. Okay, should we break? All right. Sorry about the mess up with the text. Hope you guys have your game viewing figured out.